Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Michael Anthony Ingram calling from the great city of Washington, D.C. I'm here tonight with Tizenya Pinchback. Tizenya, are you there?
I'm here.
Fantastic. This should be a very joyous occasion tonight. Poems to share, questions to answer, and we'll get started. Question for you, Tizenya. What is poetry? What is poetry?
Oh, that's a good question. You know what poetry is? I think poetry is beauty. I think it's beauty.
Tell me more.
Anything you find, well, things you create. I think the way a person puts together their life can be poetry. I think making the determination that you're going to find just one piece of joy every day, no matter what. I think that's poetry. Various types of art, building things, creating things, the way someone, you know, the way an architect or a designer might decide to, you know, design or create a curvature of a piece of stone or brick or wood. I think all of that is poetry. So, for me, poetry is just trying to excavate the beauty out of the mundane or just the everyday, the any day. That's what poetry is for me.
Excavate the beauty out of the mundane. That is such a powerful line.
Thank you.
That really, really is. Well, let me ask this question then so we know what it is. Why is it important? Mm-hmm. Why is it important?
Oh, gosh, why is it important? Because there's so little beauty running around every day. I think expression is important, to be able to express how you feel, to express what you're thinking. Communication is important when you know, if you're sitting in your house and you're looking out the window and you just happen to notice a bluebird. This summer, my daughter, she's 22. She just finished college, and she just noticed. I mean, obviously, she's seen them, you know, millions of times before, but she just noticed this bluebird or these bluebirds that come to the bird feeder in our backyard. And every day for a month, I would see her standing in the same window watching these birds, and the way she would speak about the birds and their feathers and, you know, the little trailing of silver when they kind of fly away, how it kind of stays with the bird feeder and stays with her. That's poetry, and that's important. You know, something happens or something is happening with her now that wasn't happening, you know, 6 months ago or 6 days before that. And she said to me, I'm going to write about it. And I said, you should. My daughter's not a poet, but she just happened to mention, she's like, I'm going to write about it, I think. That's important. It's important to be able to capture these things, these little things, these things that might go unnoticed. And words live forever. You know, it doesn't just, they don't just kind of disintegrate into a mist or an ether, they, you know, you write it down, or if you don't write it down and you tell someone, they carry on and they live and they linger and languish and they grow. And I think that's important to capture those things. I think that's important.
I agree. Well, without further ado, please share one of your works.
So you're going to ask me, what is poetry and why is poetry important? And I talk about the bluebird and my daughter, and then you say, let's do a poem. And I'm looking at the mm-hmm. first poem I had queued up to do, and it's just mm-hmm. such a hard shift from what we were just saying.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm going to, like I told you before the call, that I'm going to let the spirit lead me and guide me. So,
well, you know, sometimes life can be a hard shift. Things happen when you least expect it, regardless of the plans that you make.
I know where you're nudging me. I know where you're nudging me. Okay. I got it. So,
yes.
this first piece, I would say it's a work in progress, maybe. I've been sitting with it for a couple of months. And just to give you a little context and not too much. We've seen so much in the news lately and so much, you know, reading different occurrences of black women and women of color having these incidents when they go to the doctor, that they're not being heard, or they're either dying in childbirth, or something that should have been caught much earlier isn't or hasn't been caught because of this implicit bias with the medical community and just kind of devaluing women's voices and especially women of color. And I found that very interesting. My cancer diagnosis 2 years ago was delayed by 9 months because the original doctor I went to just refused to take me seriously. And by the time he did, I found out that I had been walking around with cancer that could have been, you know, I could have been getting it treated 9 months before. So, yeah, so this is kind of born from that space. So here we go with the hard shift.
All right.
The title of this piece is Girl with Black Sounding Name Records Message on Prescription Refill Line. Seeking panacea for exaggerated or phantom pain. 4 1/2 decades, black woman flesh disposable, burdened with pain. Pronounced ta-zin-ya, verb from Hebrew, meaning to listen for, hear. Spelled T-Z-Y-N-Y-A. The first letter, T, is a stop. Disrupts airflow. Quick, sharp, staccato, repeat after me. Tuh, tuh, tuh. Hard, like turmeric. Tincture, like something ground in teeth. Held tight in the hand till the fingers cramp and bleed. When I feel tainted, remind me I am holy. Like tumor or tomorrow is unpromised. The next letter, Z, is a voiced consonant. Place hand on throat to feel a slight vibration when you make the Z sound, like zinnias in the window box overlooking the sick bed. Like what's his is ours and other harbingers of doom. Like zip close your lips and legs because shrill and sex on a woman is danger. Then, masquerading as a vowel, the letter Y, pressed close to N to make the een sound. like spleen, like obscene, the fat body left to rot with disease. What do you mean, newfound brain mass, origin unknown? Before puncture, you must clean the skin. In this space, write the name of competent person over the age of 18 serving as your healthcare proxy. Another letter, Y, palatal. Your tongue's bed touching the roof of your mouth, dense like yes. Yellow is the color a bad liver paints the skin, like yield before pulling into traffic. Yield before diving into cold water or arms of man who will match your fidelity with cruelty, leaving you maligned, a marriage of his bad cells growing inside you 20 years. And finally, we arrive at the letter A, but short and frail, an open back vowel. Your lips do not curve round like mama, I'm afraid, like Yah, like Yah, like Yahweh, like God. End poem.
What was it like to share that first?
A little fun. It's so much play with words and sounds. When I wrote it, I read it to a couple of friends, and the first thing I said was, "Does it sound angry? I don't want to sound angry."
All right.
And then I thought about it. You know, why not? Sometimes
why not?
You're angry. Yeah, sometimes you're angry. So, I feel like it sets the tone of this piece sets the tone of what I'm writing right now. I don't usually write pieces that are so spot on, but you know, this feels almost a little on the nose, so I've been sitting with it for a while and kind of revising it and making sure that I have a good balance of the power that I think is possible with this piece, but also remembering to pull a little bit of the beauty. I always want my pieces to have something beautiful in them. I hope that I'm accomplishing this with this piece.
Yes, you are. So you would say then that some of the predominant themes of your work include what?
You know, I think right now, and I guess, you know, I'm sure in a year, or maybe different in a year, or maybe different in a week, but I think right now I'm really interested in sort of interrogating the Black woman body and what that means. And especially, you know, being a cancer survivor and having my own health challenges as I kind of navigate through the beginnings of, you know, survivorship and wellness and things like that. So I'm really looking at how the Black woman body is over-policed by the world and what it means to own that body, and especially to own it when it's imperfect, when it's too old, it's too young to have a voice, it's not well, it's unwell, it's healing, it's transforming. So I'm really looking at that and how we, as Black women, how we consume, how we take things in, how we take in the good stuff, the not-so-good stuff, things that we're doing, how are we affecting our bodies. I feel like as a Black woman in the world, our bodies are owned by everyone else, and we have to ask permission to kind of take back the key you know, kind of take back that space and just say, you know, no, this is me, this is mine. So I'm kind of working through a lot of body and kind of ownership, I guess.
We have a caller, and I'd like to bring this person in, if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
Caller, the last four digits of your telephone number is 7652. You're on the air.
Hi there. Hi.
Hello.
I actually had a comment and not a question. I'm so happy that you have Ms. Pinchback reading tonight because I think she is incredibly gifted.
I agree.
Thank you. Thank you. What's your question?
When is your, will you have any public readings, in-person readings, anytime soon?
You know what? I do. I have a reading coming up in October, Saturday, October 12th. I don't have a location yet, but it's in Brooklyn, and it's part of the PEN America Lit Crawl, New York City. So it's between 6 and 9 p.m. and Saturday, October 12th. And they have all these different locations and venues, non-poetry or non-literary venues. And we're still waiting to get the information of the location. But I am doing a reading there, and it'll be my first reading in New York. So
oh, wow.
I'm excited about that. Yeah, so I'm really excited about that. A little nervous because I walk with a walking cane now since cancer. So the whole being pedestrian and being back in a big city with a cane is it's kind of a little overwhelming, but I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a really great experience. So that's what I have coming up. I have another reading coming up in October as well, and that one is October 26th, and that is at the Aiken Library. And this is horrible because I should know exactly what town it's in. It's in a small town in New York. Not in New York City. It's in upstate New York. It is in Pauling, New York. I just looked it up. Thank God for technology. But I'm reading with some members of the American Poetry Journal, and so I'm really excited. One of my first pieces that I published in a long time, a couple of years ago, was one of my favorite pieces, was published by the American Poetry Journal. And so I'm looking forward to reading with some of the staff from the journal at the library. So that is October 26th. And it's not an in-person reading, but it's a virtual in-person reading through the Poets in Pajamas reading series. So I'm doing a Facebook Live reading this coming Sunday. So Sunday the 15th.
How can we find it?
You can go to Poets in Pajamas reading series on Facebook, and on their page, just like their page, and you'll actually see they have the events on their page. They have all their events lined up and videos. You can click interested, and it'll give you a reminder that it's coming up. You can also find Poets in Pajamas on Twitter as well. So either one of those poets, just Google search Poets in Pajamas, and their social media links will show up, and you can click to attend the video, and it will start at 7 p.m. Eastern Time Sunday, September 15th.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions, caller?
No, that was the only question. I am going to do my best to make the Brooklyn reading.
Oh, that's super exciting. If you see me stumbling because my equilibrium is not quite straight, you know, just know that sometimes it's, you know, sometimes the you know, sometimes it happens that way.
That's okay. The writer's circle is a strong net. We will catch you.
Poets persevere.
All right. Well, thank you, caller, very much for
calling
in. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here at Xenia Pinchback. The telephone number is 646-787-1631. Xenia, what sparked your initial love of poetry?
Probably music, I think. My dad's a musician, and I grew up, you know, listening to him arrange strings and composing and songwriting. My dad used to travel a lot when I was little, and because he would travel with his band. And whenever he would travel, he would always call us at night, and it was just me and my mom before my brothers were born. And he would always play a song for us, or he would sing a song, or kind of recite a poem for the two of us late at night before bed. And so that's probably where I, even before I realized it, that's probably where I initially kind of started to love poetry. Later in life, I would say just reading, and reading certain passages would stick out with you. I remember reading in high school, I remember reading The Temple of My Familiar by Alice Walker.
Yes.
And there is the passage that she writes, when she writes about the middle passage. And it is so stark and impossibly sad. And I just thought, how do you do that? Like, where do you go? Where do you go in this century? Where do you go? Do you ascend or descend to be able to bear witness to an atrocity that happened so long ago? And
yes.
I just remember thinking, language can do that. You know, words can take you somewhere else, can give you almost like a haunting type of, you know, words can kind of live like an apparition. And I think that's when I really fell in love with words. For the longest time, and even now still, oftentimes I don't make a distinction between poetry and prose when I'm
okay.
when I'm writing. Oftentimes I don't know which one it's going to be or what it's going to turn into until, you know, I get further into the revision process. And I think I just fell in love with language and words, and, you know, that's how the poetry came about.
Well, how does a poem begin with you, for you, with an idea, a form, or an image? Kind of talked about it just a little bit.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, I'm more of a narrative poet. So
okay.
almost always it starts as an image. It starts as an image or something I've seen. Something has just kind of grabbed me and it just won't let go. So I
All
want
right.
to tell it, I want to tell a story. I often wish that, like, some friends of mine and some poets that, you know, that I read, I often wish that poems for me started from music, because I think it would be so much easier to write certain pieces and to kind of ensure you have that lyrical quality in it. But often for me, they start from an image. It's either something that I've dreamed or something that I've seen or something that I'm trying to imagine or trying to work out in my mind. And I just start to write them down.
All right. Well, speaking of images, please share another piece of your work.
Okay. I'm going to do a piece. I'm going to do a piece that I wrote about my mother. I wrote it for my mother. My mother is she's a retired nurse, but I've grown up watching my mother be a caretaker. It's something that's come natural to her. It's something that she's very, very good at. And specifically, I remember asking her when an aunt of mine had cancer years ago, my mother took off and moved in with them to be her caregiver when she was doing hospice at home. And I remember calling my mom one night and asking her, aren't you afraid that you might be there when she dies, if you're, mm-hmm. you know? And she wasn't afraid of that. She was sad, but she wasn't afraid of it. And I remember her saying that she had witnessed people dying in hospice, many times, all the time, for decades. And she said the important thing for her to remember, if it's one of her patients, is oftentimes people would have like a fear or a trepidation, and she felt that it was her job to kind of help them transition, to make them as comfortable and to speak to them and let them know that it was going to be okay. Right. And I just thought that was really courageous. So I wrote this piece about her, or maybe for her, and the title is Pallbearers. They are singing a song for the living, lamentations to the burden and gift each new day on which your name is written. A song full-throated at once harkens back to the warmth and lush florals of youth, your lily of the valley, your sandalwood and myrrh, your tangerine sweet and sun-kissed skin mapping its lyrics. A ha ha ha, hee hee song of merriment, by ritual feast and ornamentation spirited, bearing of children and fires lit against the sky to mark the victory of their birth. They are singing a song for the dead, tongue heavy with prey, knowing night falls, a dense fog lingering underfoot, or gale swift at your back, washing and redressing the day, a pulse thready beneath its fingers, throwing open the window and its trimmings, a tide quaking beneath its lyric, sing you onto the morrow where there is no lament. Thank you.
Another very powerful piece.
Thank you.
Very vivid.
Thank you.
Very vivid. Very vivid. Tell us about your process. Is it pen and paper, computer, notebooks? How do you write?
Oh man. I wish I had like some profound, like, oh, I have a space in my house. I'm just not that disciplined. I'm not that organized. So here's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I have a day job, like many creative people, do. And I find that poems and things I want to write about just come rushing toward me when I'm in the midst of editing a proposal to submit to a corporation, or if I'm in the middle of a conference call or a meeting and doing something completely different that has absolutely no poetry in it whatsoever. So what I do, I will write them wherever I am. So when I get an idea about a poem, when I get an idea that I want to write about, I just start to write. I'll write it longhand. I keep a yellow and a red Moleskine, one in my purse, one in my backpack. So at any given time, I've got pen and paper. If I'm at work, I've got my laptop out. And my process is simply this. I write the worst possible piece of crap I can because I want to get every thought out. If I'm watching like the Investigation Discovery Channel, I'm looking at true crime because I love true crime. Unfortunately, a person with anxiety, I probably shouldn't watch those things, but I do. And I'll read about like a serial killer or like some weird mystery, and I will just write the worst crap. One day I'm going to publish a collection of first drafts, and it's going to be so horrendous and awful. I mean, they're just things that are so terrifying and horrible in life, and my first drafts are it. So I just write whatever comes to mind. I'll write the name of the person or the name of the town or the city or whatever the images that I have in my head, and I just put everything in it. It's like I'm just ransacking my house and just picking up garbage cans and refrigerators and old sofas, and I'm just throwing everything in it, and then I just leave it alone and come back to it, in a couple of days, sometimes in a couple of weeks, sometimes in a couple of months, and I just kind of pull on my, I guess, my editor's cap, and then I just go into it. But when I first start with a piece, I'm not looking for beauty. I don't want anything to sing. I just want everything. I want the city dump on a piece of paper. It could be a napkin. It could be, a blank sheet of paper. It could be my laptop. It doesn't matter. I just want everything just grimy and horrible and festering and boiling over and, just like a cauldron of toxicity. And then...
Wow. A cauldron of toxicity. Say that three times in a row.
And then that way I can go and like strip it away and I can massage it and I can, you have these lines that you think are really great and they're awful. They're not great. They're never, nothing that comes out of me in a first draft is ever great. My daughter and I have this ongoing inside joke. I was one of my poems that is, it actually is just a great poem. In Pallbearers, my first draft, I literally have in my Moleskine that I have right next to me, I have a line that says bright pink feathers on the windowsill. It makes no sense at all. I don't know where it came from. It has no relevance to that piece. There's no reference point for it. But in my gathering and culling together of garbage to make a first draft, that's what came out. So that's my process. And I just strip away and revise and strip away and revise. And then I kind of put it away and I come back to it. I wish I was the kind of writer that could write like a really good first draft. And then the second draft is like just golden. That, mm-hmm. that doesn't happen to me. It's got to bake for a long time. I got to put it in the freezer. Got to put some, you put in the Ziploc bag, throw it on the counter, crush it up a little bit. It's, you know, so that's my process. You know, maybe when I mature a bit, I don't know. I don't know. I'm in my 40s, so I don't know how much more maturing I'm going to get with my writing. But maybe someday I'll have like an area in the house in my sprawling estate, and where I will write lovingly, beautiful things on the first draft. But right now, that ain't what's happening.
You know, based on everything that I've heard so far, it sounds like you were born to be a poet. The question is, do you believe the same? Do you believe the same? Were you born to be a poet? Were you meant
to
be
a
poet? That's how they pay me the big bucks.
You know, I thought I was born to be a ballerina. That's I thought I was going to be. I thought I was going to be a ballerina. I studied ballet from, like, the age of 4 until I was 13 or 14.
Wow,
I was
the
in
ballet
love with dance.
Right.
Yeah, I was in love with dance way before I was in love with the concept of writing as, you know, something you did seriously. I don't know. Is one born to be a poet? I think I'm a storyteller. I think of myself as a storyteller. And sometimes those stories come out as poems. Sometimes they come out just as some, you know, prose writing. Sometimes they come out in photography. Sometimes they come out gift wrapping. I'm like an amazing gift wrapper. I do magic with gift wrapping and Christmas tree. Like, I curate this entire Christmas tree experience with the tree and the depth and the spatial concepts. And, you know, so I was meant to make things. I was born to make things. And poems are one of the things that I make. So
there you
have it.
Well, as you think about life and the good, bad, and indifferent of it, what do you see as being the role of a poet in modern-day society? What's our role?
Oh, to tell the truth.
Yes.
To shine the light, to do no harm. There's so much harm being done. Do no harm, you know. Tell the truth. Unmask what is being hidden. Serve society. If your words aren't serving anyone, you know, other than yourself, what's the point? That's just masturbation.
Right.
What's the point?
Well, speaking of that, please share another piece of your work.
Okay. I'm going to do a little bit of a scary poem since it's September. And September 1st for me is officially autumn and pumpkins and Halloween.
Well, Halloween is in October.
I know.
The very end of October.
I know, right? It's the very last day of October.
Very last day.
Get it. And I'm one of those people that September 1st rolls around and I am, you know, 2 feet into autumn because I love autumn. I don't drink pumpkin spice latte, but I am a friend to those who do. So, you know, I'm your tribe. I embrace you because I'm everything autumn. I'm there for it. So,
right.
This piece, it's a short piece, but it's fun. I like this piece a lot. I was thinking about when people tell your story or they tell your history, they kind of own a piece of it. So I got them. It got me thinking. What if the Wicked Witch in Oz really wasn't wicked? Of course she's wicked if you read the story from the point of view of Dorothy. So
yes.
It got me thinking, you know. So this, the title of this piece is short. Presumed dead, Oz expatriate claims squatter's rights in Kansas. I am want and rain, wall cloud a pulse against my seat bone, stirring the river of feral rams, limb, sap, and heifer's claw, a putrid debris on my hat's brim. Three heel clicks from your door, poppy, red like tongue swelled hot with curse and pray, a bouquet under my finger's nail. I am sunflower plucked bare, storm cellar spun up, gold brick dust and a tone, both glint and eye. Tin woodsman's axe up sleeve of my yellow flicker, loose sequin, ruby slippers. Thank you.
Three clicks from your door. Three heel clips.
Oh, yeah.
Clicks from your door. I like that.
I'm coming. I like the idea of the witch coming to Kansas to find Dorothy.
Yes.
And to claim her squatter's rights. And to get her shoes back. Hey,
you know,
you ever had a really good pair of shoes fit your feet really well?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
I'd ride a tornado to get my shoes back.
That's so funny.
It's not evil if it's a necessity. Everybody needs shoes.
Listen. All great writers and performers have great writing influences. You mentioned Alice Walker. Who are some of your influences and what makes them great in your eyes?
Oh, you know, let me tell you. Good. See, here we go. Here we go. So, I will start with this piece, the poem that I just read. That poem was influenced by a poet that I know from Maine, Anne Brighting Olson. She's a dear friend. She's so kind. And we started off just as Facebook friends. We had the opportunity a year ago to actually meet in person because I did a reading in Maine, and I went up there for one day, and she actually came out to see me. During the reading. But one thing I remember is I ordered a lot of books when I was going through chemo. I just would go through and order a lot of books by writers that I knew or that I was acquainted with. I just wanted to catch up on my reading list. And I got a collection of poems, of Anne's poems. And I remember her poetry just sitting with me and comforting me, and it just felt like, you know, a friend sitting with you during chemo when I would go in for chemo or when I was sitting at home and nights when I couldn't sleep. And I just enjoyed her writing. And I actually became acquaintances with her through social media before I really became acquainted with her work. So it was such a nice surprise because here's this person that I chatted with and we laughed on social media, and then to really kind of immerse myself in her work, that just really, it was really thrilling. And I feel like things like that are you know, are really a gift. Mm-hmm. When I think about writers who just move me, I cannot go go beyond right this moment Toni Morrison.
Tell me why.
Man, come on.
I know why, but
here's the thing.
But you tell me.
Here's the thing with Toni. I was a weird, spooky little girl, and I'm a weird, spooky lady now. So when you discover Toni Morrison, when you, you know, when she's writing about the little boy standing in the door with the corn husk doll and the dead mother coming back to speak to her daughter and trying to give her daughter kind of a warning and serve as an omen, and she writes about this love language between mother and daughter and women, you know, when the women are coming and they're praying and they're rebuking and they're coming from the town and they're walking up the road, you know, to basically put the apparition to bed.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh my gosh, somebody had given permission for me to be this freakishly weird pseudo psychic, having dreams about things or knowing things that you can't really explain beyond intuition. And
yes.
I feel like Toni did that for me. She said to Xenia, it's okay to be a weird little black girl that, you know, doesn't like the neighbor next door and you can't explain to your parents why, but something about him just makes, you know, your shoulder
you feel
hunch,
uncomfortable.
And then you find out,
right.
Yeah, you find out 2-3 years later that, you know, he was a really bad person doing horrible things to people. And it's I remember reading, my favorite book by Toni Morrison is A Mercy. I remember reading A Mercy with my critique group years ago. Critique group, the Griot Space. And one of my dearest, dearest, dearest friends in the whole world was reading it. We were reading it together with this group. And I remember getting off work and opening, you know, to the first page. And the book, you know, it's A Mercy is like a big prose poem. And every other chapter is told from a different point of view. And, you know, Toni's not going to tell you whose point of view it is. Toni, she doesn't write down to you. You come up, you read up, and you ascend. And I remember sitting on the sofa and climbing into that book and climbing into Florence and the boots and her soft feet and why it was so important and so tragic for a young black girl at the start of slavery in Maryland and in the Americas, you know, to have soft feet. And I just thought, you know, soft, fragile feet, that she needed boots. She couldn't toughen the soles of her feet. She couldn't walk barefoot. And I remember when I would close that book, I would have to extricate myself, like my arms and my shoulders and my feet and my elbow and my knee and my décolletage. And, you know, it's just like every piece of me, this the left braid, and you just immerse in that. And there's something in Toni's writing that just gives you permission to believe in the supernatural. You know,
yes.
She gives you the permission to understand that when you're walking your path, there's always two paths beside you. There are other worlds and there are parallel experiences, and no one is ever really dead. You know, someone's always reaching back and someone's always reaching forward. And I just cannot find the words to illustrate the beauty and the magic and just the genius of Toni Morrison. And yeah, I've been writing a piece about her for like since her death. And I was hoping to have it done for my readings this month, but I doubt it. But it's just, She died the day that I went into the hospital, that I went into the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the ICU, and that's when I learned that she had died. And the first thing that came to mind for me was A Mercy and Beloved and that mother-daughter mm-hmm. tie, that blood
mm-hmm.
tie, because I had been very sick, and I wasn't aware that how sick I was, and I was in a fugue, basically. I was starting to forget things, and it was my daughter. My daughter's the one that called 911. My daughter saved my life. So the night that my favorite author, whose work has just changed me and illuminated me, the night that the woman who has given voice to that mother-daughter, that wretched tie, that tender, sweet, you know, perilous, fragile tie between mother-daughter, the night that she died is the night that my daughter saved my life a month ago.
Wow.
And
it's very powerful.
I don't know what to do with that. So that's why I've been writing it, because I don't know what to do with that. I don't know how to approach it. I don't know how to distill it. So that may take a while, but yeah, I don't know what the universe wanted to do with that or how that happened, why it happened that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, for the rest of my life, you know, my daughter saved my life the night Toni Morrison died. If that could be a tattoo, that's my tattoo for the rest
of my
life.
That's your tattoo.
That's a before and after, you know, point in my story. So.
And it's a very powerful story. Very powerful. Let's take a brief break and we'll be right back. We are back. I am Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Yesenia Pinchback, and this is an incredible program. Yesenia, you're extremely talented. Your words are like music. Your words are like music. And I'm incredibly thrilled that you're with me tonight. Please share another piece of your work.
Okay. So let's see here. I am going to do a piece that is one of my favorites. I wrote it for my dad. The title is Traveling Mercies. Quote, "And Aretha is the last sound they hear before dying. From Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. Ain't no way I left town without the pitch of her yell, the swell of her moan, a river through my speakers after you, squatting beside my car to place hand to fender in prayer, the road Denver to Nashville rise to greet me, eyes gray and glinting with tears, told me goodbye for the last time. After craft beers and breakfast in lower downtown, you said, ain't no way these gastropub biscuits taste better with seeded black jam than the art of your scratch gravy. Bleached flour over grease drippings, scrambled in cast iron until almost burnt black, before seeping in water and whisking together slowly, slowly like night rolling into dawn. like the morning I awoke at your bedside, reclined and counting the seconds between your exhalations. And ain't no way, in that lingering silence, after the final rush of air left your lungs, filling the room with your exit, I didn't bargain for time enough to pray you safe passage, my tongue a vinyl groove repeating, call me the moment you get there. Thank you.
Call me the moment you get there.
That's my favorite Aretha Franklin song. Yep, that's my favorite Aretha song. It is.
I adore that song.
See, you have people on this, people that listen to your podcast, and they think that you're, they're like, oh my gosh, Michael is so, he's so smooth and so. See, they don't know how you talk to the guests before the podcast starts. They don't know that you want to sing that lyric. Call me the moment you get there.
Well, hey, share another piece of your work.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
I don't mind. Let's see here. I've got one that's very domestic. This one is, there's not much magical in this one. This one is about returning to work after being laid off and being sick and going back to work, and you're walking with a cane and, you know, you're trying not to look sick, and you start to understand how life is for people who are precariously or who have precarious mobility.
Yes.
And just, you know, and when you're no longer 25. And this one is called A Load-Bearing Wall. 1 month, she said, just 4 weeks, 20 business days, 40 punches on the time clock, in, out, editor with impaired mobility, 8 hours sitting with knees at 90-degree angle behind a desk on the fourth floor of an office building with an unreliable elevator. They want to see how you interact with the team, she said. Theirs is a collaborative culture, a work hard, play hard, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., but will work late into the night and on weekends, which happens almost every night and every weekend, to get the job done. Dunkin' Donuts in the lobby next to a 24-hour state-of-the-art employee fitness center and martinis after dark type of culture. 1 month, she said, just 4 weeks, 5 days up at dawn, legs over edge of bed and into the standing position, one hand on the side table, the other on your partner's shoulder, while the unrelenting flame that licks your pelvis and lower limbs dances you awake. You came highly recommended 2 weeks after losing a job, arriving just 4 minutes before the start to the interview, a spasm seizing your right foot at the exact moment you shook her hand. Pretending not to notice your lumbering gait, she pointed to the rows of cubicles outstretched before you and said, in the end, we're all just cheap labor. 1 month, and you are counting. 92 steps to the water cooler, 3 flights up the back stairwell, careful to avoid your cane getting caught in the loose carpet on the landing, past the large writer's supply cabinet to the one stall bathroom for the handicapped. 20 minutes now, teeter on legs gone soft, their skin like stretched elastic socks pulling at your ankles. dry chew 4 tabs of Advil and wait. The tiled wall cool against your back. Thank you.
You know, writers and poets write for a myriad of reasons. Some write primarily to speak a message to their audience. Others write because to stay silent is not an option. Why do you write, Tuzinya?
Because I'm emotionally unstable oftentimes,
okay.
And it's better for me to write than to run around outside screaming.
Okay. All right.
My head is on fire.
Hey. Who am I?
Writing helps me. Writing helps. You know what? Writing helps with my anxiety. When I write it out, I have to confront it. So I write things that scare me. Oftentimes, I write things that I'm afraid of. I write things that scare me. Things that I have some trepidation. And when I write it, it's right there. You can't help but see it, and that forces me to confront it on my terms in a safe space. So,
Wow.
So that will be
well. We've come to the end of the hour. Can you believe it?
And I'm not any good in math, so I should probably write. I can't count. I'm like I got you to like from 1 to 20, and after that, then you're on your own. So there you have it.
I could listen to you read all night long. You
Thank
are,
you, Michael,
as I said, an incredible artist. I mean,
Thank
the nuances
you.
In
Thank
your
you
voice
very
as
much.
You're reading, it's, I really, really could.
Thank
I really
you.
Could. You know, when people hear your work, and you've kind of talked about it in terms of some of your upcoming performances, they usually want more. So what's next for you as a poet overall? As a poet,
I am working toward a second manuscript for a second chapbook. So I'm working on pieces. I think I'm kind of putting together a collection of work about the body, the physical body, the spiritual body, the social body, the community body, however you interpret the body. And I'm doing a lot of writing and working, and it's hard to tell because some of these pieces that I read today are a little dark, but I'm working on pieces of joy. I want to write about things that are, I want to write about joyful things, things that bring me joy and you know. So I'm hoping to finish a collection. I don't know, I don't want to give a time frame, but that's what I'm working toward. I'm working on a collection of pieces, mainly poems, maybe a couple of essays on the body.
Wow. Well, tell me briefly about How to Make Pink Confetti, your chapbook.
How to Make Pink Confetti is a group of about 10 poems, and it's really based on this fairy tale that I kind of created, if you can call it a fairy tale, but it's basically just it's a woman who fell in love. She was a mermaid. She fell in love with a sailor boy, and she left the ocean to be with him. She didn't have to give up anything. She didn't have to make any deals with anyone. Her father didn't, you know, curse her or whatever for leaving the ocean. She just made the decision to leave the ocean to be with him on land. And they, you know, they were in love, very passionate, and her sailor boy started to become fearful that she was going to someday leave him to go back to the ocean, that she would miss the ocean and that she would leave the land. So he gathered one night with his buddies down by the dock, and they were drinking, and he says, you know, I got this mermaid. love her. I adore her, but I can feel her slipping away back into the ocean. And someone gave him the recommendation, you know, if you get rid of her scales, she won't be able to live in the ocean. And another friend told him, you know, a dull knife is the best way to scale a fish.
Oh, wow.
So that's what he did while she was sleeping. He descaled her. But even as he descaled her and as her scales were falling away, it made a beautiful confetti on the floor beneath where they slept. And how to make pink confetti is based on that story that I actually told my daughter when she was three. If you can imagine, this was a story I made it for my daughter when she was three. And the pieces in pink confetti are just about women, how to undo a woman, how to take away from, how to subtract from a woman, how to basically make destruction, but also knowing that when you do that, when you endeavor to destroy, to, you know, decompose, to deconstruct a woman, there's still that beauty there. Even in the debris, there's still that beauty. So you can never truly take that away. And that's what those pieces are born from.
Do you know that we started with the word beauty? Excavating
and
beauty.
And we ended with some beauty.
And we ended with the word beauty. Or you did. So it's truly full circle.
Oh, very good. It's like we planned it. Look how it came all natural.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much. And I'd like you to return to the show sometime in 2020.
I will, absolutely. Thank you for having me. Maybe
yes.
By the time I come in 2020, I will have finished my Toni Morrison piece.
That'd be beautiful.
Imagine
that'd be beautiful.
That.
Well, thank you and good night to you. And good night to our
thank
listening
you.
Audience. Next week, we're here with Todd Cirillo. Have a good evening, everyone.